Hi everyone, welcome to our session with Jane Nursey about PTSD. So Jane is a registered clinical neuropsychologist. She currently holds the position of Director Centenary of ANZAC Professional Support Service at Phoenix, Australia. Jane has 25 years experience in the public hospital and not-for-profit sectors as a senior clinician, manager and director of programs, working with groups and individuals across the lifespan in both acute and mental health services. She has expertise in the development and implementation of clinical service programs, policy and service development advice to government, services and industry apply best practice support to staff and clients suffering from trauma-related mental health issues. Jane has extensive experience in developing and implementing training programs for mental health providers, community members and high-risk industry workforces on identifying and managing trauma-related mental symptoms and disorders. Jane has sat on numerous state government and hospital-based advisory groups responsible for developing innovative programs and improving service delivery in both child and adolescent and adult health and mental health services. Please join me in welcoming Jane.
Thank you. Hello? Yeah. I actually hate using microphones, so if I keep drifting away, I'm sorry about that. But I also hate standing behind podiums, so we'll see how we go. Thank you, Kelly, and thanks to EML and the conference organisers for inviting Phoenix along to present today. A really important presentation, I think, and we're really appreciative of the opportunity to talk to the insurance industry about PTSD. My aim is really to try and give you a bit of an overview of where things are at in terms of our understanding and of PTSD, its presentation and treatment, but really try to focus primarily on prevention and early intervention, particularly in emergency service workers. There's a bit of background information I want to get through first that I'm going to try and race through so that we can get to the meaty part. Just in terms of giving a bit of background context of who we are, we're a not-for-profit organisation. We sit within the University of Melbourne, but aren't a university department. We're not funded through university funding. But our mission is really to try and improve the understanding of trauma and its impacts and to promote recovery, really. And we do that through a range of different work. So we do a lot of research work in developing innovative treatments and looking at trauma in specialist populations. We do a lot of policy and service development work with different industries. So I do a lot of work with emergency services, rail industry, media industry, veteran and military as well. And we do a lot of training of mental health clinicians and health professionals around evidence-based treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as a lot of community education around increasing awareness about the impacts of trauma and how to support each other. In terms of emergency service workers, there are at least 80,000 personnel employed in emergency services across Australia. And when we think about a prevalence rate of approximately 10% in emergency service workers with PTSD, that's a reasonably large number of people who are being impacted. In order to understand PTSD, you really need to understand what a traumatic incident is or what trauma is. So trauma is unique in the sense that it's not something like bullying or chronic stress. It really is a unique event that challenges the capacity of the person to cope. And usually involves some sort of overwhelming threat to the person's life or sense of self and integrity. And there can be single isolated events, or there can be cumulative events or chronic and ongoing prolonged events that might make up that traumatic experience.
I've gone through a few traumatic experiences like near misses. I've gone through attended fatalities. I've been part of assaults where I've been assaulted or I've witnessed assaults.
Usually in our situation as a train driver, we're the only one that witnesses it. And that's probably a big factor in the causes of trauma. I think after a number of critical incidents, it's not unusual for people to become more emotive and reactionary to everyday work practices and people outside.
Sometimes you can feel high, you can feel low, you're questioning yourself all the time.
You do tend to withdraw a little bit. You don't want to be reminded too much of it.
You're not feeling yourself. You snap at people.
So you do have trouble sleeping. Once you do get to sleep, it's usually on daybreak. If you wake early before the sun, that's when the memories of it tend to come back.
Most rail workers will experience or witness a fatality or a near miss at some point in their working lives. There's an obligation on all of us to ensure these workers know that they don't have to pick up the pieces on their own, and that we will be there with them to ensure that they can get back to work as soon as they can.
So it's just an example of a video that TrackSafe produced for their workers in terms of helping them to understand the sorts of exposures we're talking about and the impacts of those sorts of exposures. And when we get down to talking about prevention and early intervention, I want to sort of hark back and talk about these sorts of products. In relation to determining a diagnosis of PTSD, there's a very specific requirement around what trauma involves in order to get that diagnosis. So first of all, there needs to be either direct exposure or witnessing of an event that threatens death or serious injury, either to the person themselves or to someone else. It can occur through learning that a close relative or someone very close to them has been involved in such an incident. And it also can come through exposure to occupational exposure to unpleasant events that where other people are getting threatened. So a good example of that are crime investigators looking at child pornography material, for instance, or child exploitation material. Another one is counter-terrorism officers looking at a range of abhorrent material on video. So needing to look at that on a constant basis throughout their workday. There are a range of different recovery or response trajectories with trauma. For the majority of people, that's recovery trajectory. So the majority of people are likely to show some initial signs of distress that can come through behavioural, cognitive, physical signs, increased levels of emotional distress. Those are likely to last anywhere from a few days, sometimes up to a few weeks, sometimes even a few months. But with support and through their own sort of resilience capacities, the recovery is a pretty natural recovery, and those things will subside pretty clearly and they'll go on and not really show any long-lasting impacts. There's another group that luckily don't experience any real distress, who manage to get through those events quite well and are considered to be a fairly resilient group. There's a group that have a delayed onset of symptoms post-trauma, and that can be anywhere from months to years post-trauma. And we see that a lot in the military. We see it a lot in police and emergency service workers as well, where some years down the track, and whether it be cumulative impact over time, whether it be certain life events, whether it be getting to a point where their normal resources are no longer allowing them to cope, there's a downturn in their capacity to function. And then there's a group who really decompensate at the time of the trauma and who have some fairly persistent difficulties and don't really recover. And probably it's those two last groups who you as an industry are likely to be looking after. On top of all of this, though, is the potential for what we call post-traumatic growth. And that is the idea that the experience of being involved in a trauma provides an opportunity for growth and development, discovering some new ambition in life or goal in life and going after that with gusto or redirecting things. So we heard Julian this morning speak about his own experiences, and we could characterise his movement forward as being evidence of post-traumatic growth. Post-traumatic stress disorder involves four key symptoms: re-experiencing the traumatic event through unwanted memories and flashbacks, nightmares, those sorts of things. A constant avoidance of anything that's going to trigger a reminder or cause upset or distress. Persisting negative thoughts. Trauma impacts the way we see at the world. It changes the way we feel safe, what we think about ourselves, what we think about others. It destroys trust. It destroys sense of safety. And there can be lots of negative thinking that goes on around those, as well as permanent changes in our capacity to feel positive, healthy emotions versus a constant feeling of being distressed and on edge. And then there's the hyperarousal symptoms, and these perhaps are the most debilitating in the sense that people's basic level of arousal is much higher than it had been prior to the trauma. They're constantly on edge. It doesn't take much to trigger them off to having a panic attack or feeling really anxious and distressed. And they find it very difficult to concentrate. They find it very difficult to apply themselves to any tasks. They're quick to anger, quick to respond to any provocation. For that reason, a PTSD has significant impacts on family life. It has significant impacts on occupational functioning and social functioning generally. And what you find with people with chronic PTSD is that they're very withdrawn from life. They lead very restricted, limited lives and are very avoidant and find it very difficult to re-engage. In terms of prevalence rates, it's much higher in emergency services. PTSD prevalence rates are much higher in emergency services than in the rest of the population. So 14.6 to 20% in ambulance officers compared to 4.4 in the general population. Ambulance officers, in fact, are much higher than firefighters and police officers. But generally, emergency service workers as a whole, the prevalence rate sits around 10%. PTSD isn't the only or the most common response to trauma. Anxiety and depression are actually much more common. And in fact, much more common than that is comorbidity. So most people with PTSD will also meet a diagnosis for depression or an anxiety disorder and or a substance abuse disorder. There are a range of risk factors for developing PTSD, and these include these factors that are up here. Now, these have we heard about Sam Harvey's work this morning in his work in developing and colleagues' work in developing mentally healthy workplaces. He's also done a lot of work in terms of developing the expert guidelines for the treatment of emergency services or heading a panel that developed those. And the sorts of work risk factors that have been identified are certainly general work stress and organisational factors. We know that in emergency service organisations, there are a lot of organisational factors that set up a person to already have some emotional, psychological distress. And they're usually in positions where they don't have a lot of control over what they're doing. They're working shift works that impacts on physical well-being. There's often a hierarchical structure with bullying involved and unfair work practices involved. And all of those things really set a person up for being at higher risk. Social support. Workplace social support generally is the strongest predictor of recovery from trauma. Those people who lack good social support are at most risk for developing PTSD post-trauma. And so, therefore, the level of social support you have in a workplace is going to be a strong predictor. Again, we know that in emergency service agencies, the idea of sharing your feelings, talking about your own experiences in a way that seeks support from others is not the culture. And so that in itself sets people up for being at risk. Whether or not the manager and leadership have an interest in supporting the well-being of their employees, an understanding, a willingness to promote mental health and well-being. And again, traditionally that hasn't been something that's been done well in emergency services. The amount of time in service and therefore the cumulative exposure to traumatic events, the more exposure to traumatic events, cumulative impact, the higher the risk. The type of incidents that people are getting exposed to, the extremity of those, how long they go on for, whether or not they match personal issues in the person's life. You know, attending a child death, for instance, might be increasingly or much more difficult for someone who has a child than not. And there's a range of individual factors also that contribute to risk. Coping styles, cognitive styles, own stresses in their own life. So the ones that I've asterisked there are the ones that really are perhaps the highest risk factors and the ones that potentially we can work to do something about in terms of early intervention and prevention work. We've heard this morning also about the economic impacts of mental health disability in general. PTSD has the highest economic impact out of all mental health disorders. It is often the most disabling mental health disorder and sometimes the most difficult to treat as well. Because it's associated with a broad range of other psychosocial and interpersonal functioning difficulties, it can be difficult, it can be slow to be ameliorated and requires multiple aspects of treatment and intervention. Recovery from PTSD, often it's considered to be a life sentence. But the reality is that for some people that develop PTSD, it's likely to improve over the next 2 to 3 years without necessarily a lot of intervention. Although we would argue that earlier intervention is going to help that process. But there's just as many people who don't recover and who go on to develop chronic disability. And the symptoms can fluctuate in intensity across time, really. So what are the treatments that work? And I guess I'm moving in to really trying, beginning to focus on the sort of issues that you as insurance groups might be interested in. So there are a range of guidelines that tell us what best treatments. The national guidelines on ASD and PTSD certainly recommend a stepped care approach. So you provide the level of care required that matches the person's needs. So there might be a universal support offered immediately post-trauma, but then there's dedicated evidence-based treatments for things like PTSD and mental health disorder. And those evidence-based treatments for PTSD include trauma-focused cognitive behavioural therapy and eye movement desensitisation reprocessing therapy. I don't have time to explain those, but I guess they're the two therapies that we'd be hoping that people will be getting if they're presenting to a psychotherapist or psychologist or mental health clinician. Medication can often be an adjunct to that and might be indicated in its own right. Those recommendations are supported by the guidelines that were developed by the Black Dog Institute, led by Sam Harvey and a group of other experts, who also endorsed the idea of trauma-focused CBT and EMDR. The evidence that we have for those is very, very strong. But there's a range of other issues that need to be addressed in emergency service workers, including the return to work being a primary sort of aim, and the psychosocial support and willingness to access help being other things that need to be addressed. Which it leads us perhaps to the whole concept of early intervention and prevention. We don't have strong evidence. Unlike the evidence around trauma-focused CBT and EMDR, we don't have strong evidence about how effective early intervention and prevention strategies are. It's very difficult to do research in this area. It's very difficult to get funding. It's difficult to set up RCTs, randomised controlled trials, and it's difficult to convince emergency service agencies to participate in research in these areas. But there certainly is expert consensus on the idea that things like mentally healthy, putting in strategies to develop mentally healthy workplaces, improving mental health literacy, and doing resilience training are three things that can potentially impact both limiting the likely prevalence of developing PTSD, but also reducing its impact. And we had a discussion about that this morning as well, and fully endorse, what was made in there. In terms of a mentally healthy workplace, that is one that's going to actively try to reduce the risks associated with developing a mental health disorder and promote resilience and mental health well-being. And there are a range of strategies that can be included in that. In emergency services, it is about identifying risk and minimising exposure to the extent that it can be done. Providing support as quickly as possible after a critical incident event. Ensuring that you're decreasing stigma within the workplace in terms of talking about how you've responded in a certain situation or what's going on for you. There's a range of literature around developing mentally healthy workplaces that's out there. Australia actually is one of the world leaders in this area, and we have lots of good policy documents and lots of good literature reviews around what that might look like. Again, Sam Harvey's groups developed these six steps that Eugene referred to earlier today in terms of providing a framework around how to go about developing mentally healthy workplaces. Mental health literacy, another really important intervention that can be used. Mental health first aid is out there. It should be used universally. If we think about all workplaces, it would be very helpful to have mental health first aid out there, but particularly in emergency services. The idea of learning what a mental health disorder might look like, how you approach a colleague who might be struggling and how to talk to them, and having some awareness of what is the path to recovery and where to access help. And there's quite good evidence around mental health first aid training having positive impacts on workplace. Even a four-hour manager's training on mental health awareness and literacy has been seen to have positive impacts in terms of reducing absence and workplace-related psychological issues. Promoting resilience is probably a bit more controversial and very difficult to establish. There are a range of programs that have been trialled, including mindfulness and cognitive behavioural therapy programs, to try and promote resilience. There's in particular a program that was implemented by Jane Shakespeare-Finch in Queensland that's called the PRO program, which was developed and in particularly trying to sort of see whether or not it could increase post-traumatic growth following a traumatic incident. And that had some pleasing results from it, but there, it was a bit too early to determine whether or not it was going to limit the onset of something like post-traumatic stress disorder. But programs that help to forewarn, that help to build personal resilience capacities through a range of different inputs, are what are being trialled out there at the moment. So what is needed? We need to increase community awareness about trauma and its impacts. We need to help people understand the signs and symptoms early and being prepared to put their hand up and to talk about it and go and seek help early. We need to make sure that evidence-based treatments are out there and that clinicians are skilled in delivering them. And we need to promote the idea that this isn't a life sentence, that recovery is possible. So there's a range of different things that can be done. So app development that provide information around trauma and trauma impacts. For emergency services workers, there's been apps developed in terms of identifying impacts of trauma, doing their own self-monitoring, giving them some skills in resilience building and self-management in terms of minimising arousal and emotional distress. The accreditation of mental health programs that aim to treat post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental health disorders by insurance groups. We've done some work with DVA in terms of setting up accreditation of trauma recovery programs that they offer, as well as some mental health group programs that they offer in hospitals. Developing pamphlets and information that is disseminated to the community or to the specialist population. In this case, EML worked with us to develop some recovery after trauma booklets for firefighters, ambulance officers, police officers that talk about PTSD, what it looks like, what recovery looks like, where to seek help. Provides some points to remember when seeking help and questions to ask of your clinician or your therapist. I'm going to skip that. A whole range of other videos that help to describe what looking after yourself might look like and what the importance of social support and what that might look like. So that this basic information is out there and getting into the awareness of people. So I think there's a whole range of opportunities for groups like yourselves to be helping to promote work in these areas, to helping to fund research in early intervention and prevention strategies in terms of engaging in accreditation of programs that you fund, in terms of helping to disseminate, develop and disseminate pamphlets, apps, information programs that get out to those high-risk groups but also out to the community at large. And advocate, I guess, for the development of evidence-based interventions and support that through supporting research in those areas. So I think I'm out of time, and I'm sorry, that is a lot of information to get through, but I'm happy to take questions.
Thanks, Jane, for that insightful presentation. Can I please request that anyone who has questions to go up to the microphone and introduce yourself before you start?
Is this on? Yeah, hi, John Killick. This is all really interesting, and yesterday and today has been fascinating. Can you give me, as an observer from the outside, the time frame and acceleration of these programs and development? Was like 5 years ago, was there nothing? And now, so I'm just trying to get a perspective on it.
So look, the whole concept of PTSD has been around since Middle Ages or earlier, really. It just hasn't been called PTSD, and that diagnosis wasn't coined until the early 1980s. So since that time, I guess in the last 30, 40 years, there's been a whole lot of research that started to investigate what post-traumatic stress disorder is and start to developing effective treatment programs. There has been an explosion of evidence in the last 5 to 10 years, particularly around the neurobiological underpinnings of PTSD and how it presents and the implications that might have in terms of treatment. The treatments that have the evidence base here, trauma-focused cognitive behavioural therapy and prolonged exposure, EMDR, have been around for a good 25 years, and for that reason have a reasonable evidence base behind them. There's a whole range of other treatments that keep coming up that don't necessarily get subjected to rigorous research in terms of how effective they are, but nevertheless get taken up by different groups and practitioners. So things like yoga and equine therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy and mindfulness and those sorts of things, all of which might, and certainly with mindfulness and yoga and physical activity, all of those have a useful role to play in adjunctives to therapeutic input, and there's increasing evidence around those, but that's certainly been much more a slower development and happening over the last 5 to 10 years.
Scenarios I've heard from regarding paramedics, police officers, army, military is the one you hear most about the PTSD. But the people in the day-to-day workforce, it's the development of the support for them and the training of managers in paramedic, in the ambulance services and other things. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, and I think that the emergency services and the military, for that matter, have really had barriers to opening up to understanding PTSD and how it impacts their lives and that it's even an issue within their industries. And I think there has been a strong shift in the last 5 to 10 years, led by military and now sort of filtering through other emergency service workers. From our own experience, we've been working with the military for over 30 years in terms of trying to improve their understanding of PTSD and get effective policy and practice in place. Police have been on board a lot later than that in terms of allowing us to come in and other groups like us to come in and start doing some research, and that's probably been more over the last 10 to 15 years. Firefighters are a group that generally have been very resistant and still are incredibly resistant to going in and helping them in this area. Ambulance officers, interestingly, who are perhaps the group highest risk and suffer the most, are also beginning to pull down some of those barriers and being open to making changes.
My daughter's a paramedic,
that's
all the other reasons I'm interested in.
Okay, yeah.
I think we have time for two quick questions.
Hi, Jane, I'm Rebecca. I listened to, at another presentation a year or so ago, a really interesting talk about community responses historically to PTSD and in the world wars and how community response was to hide away people who were suffering from nerves or shock, as they called it at that time, and that we haven't done that well historically, even though we have all this evidence of what trauma causes, what the impact of trauma is. And we saw generations affected by alcohol abuse after wars, and we saw it, I think, as a community, as a very personal family problem rather than a community problem. And I'm wondering now if you think, with the advances in technology and neuroimaging, if we can crack through that issue that we've had in communities in terms of acceptance of PTSD, in a way that will allow us to do what you were talking about before. Is, you know, I think, and I agree with you, community piece is really important. We can do all the interventions in the workplace, but if our community and our culture doesn't accept that PTSD exists, then we've got some problems.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And I do think, you know, our understanding the neurobiology in a more in-depth way does provide some openings and new opportunities. And I've actually been running groups on the neuropsychology of trauma in veteran and military and police treatment and emergency service treatment programs for over 20 years. And I have to say that it is one of the parts of the program that really starts to open them up to thinking that this isn't something that's internally wrong with me. There's something going on that in my brain that's promoting these symptoms, and has allowed for communication between spouses and families to talk about how trauma impacts. And just the very fact that it allows for those conversations to start happening means that there's much more opportunity, I think, to then be educating families and the public about trauma impacts and how to support it. I have to say that one of the areas that has been grossly underfunded in treatment and under-researched in treatment as well is supports for family members. We know that this has a significant impact, a multi-generational impact on families, and yet there are no agencies that are prepared to fund. There's no insurance groups that I'm aware of. That certainly DVA and the military don't fund support for families in terms of managing their own reactions to their family member having PTSD. So I think that that's another area that really requires a lot of input. But yes, I do think it provides a new opportunity.
So we have time for one last quick question.
I was going to have probably one and a half questions. The first quick one is, like, you provide the journey to recovery chart early, illustrating the pathways. Have you seen anyone who recovered but then sort of gets sucked back in to the trauma? The second question is, you also mentioned how insurance industry can get involved more in the research and help. Like, have you, not necessarily in a harsh way, but have you seen the insurance industry done anything over the past, in your 20 years career in this field? What have the insurance industry done, or what have changed over that time?
So first of all, I have to say that graph is a little bit artificial, because the reality is things go up and down. And you can certainly have people who do recover, but who then might demonstrate symptoms again down the track. Something else triggers a relapse, if you like. That's not an unusual presentation. So they become symptomatic again, but are likely to recover more quickly with good support and intervention at that point. In terms of insurance, I actually think that the insurance industry has done quite a bit. And, you know, from my own, I guess I can't talk generally, but from my own personal experience being involved in disaster recovery, there's been quite a lot of really positive initiatives done by insurance groups in terms of looking at community education and community support to minimise impacts. They've run a number, I was involved in a number of sort of workshops and days in and developing research proposals that they might fund in terms of implementing particular strategies and programs. DVA, the whole defence and military, if we call that insurance, compensation schemes within that, also have made dramatic changes in the way they support people with PTSD and allow access to trauma, and also in terms of the accrediting programs to make sure that they're evidence-based. And I would see them perhaps as leaders in that area. But there's been a lot of interest coming from insurance groups around that and wanting to do similar sorts of things. So I think that there are positive initiatives happening.
Yep. We might finish up there for today. Please remember to fill in your speaker feedback through the app. Thank you, Jane.
Okay.